What do I do about this? I can move over. Seems fine to me. Joan, there was a moment there when you started when I could tell that you'd been a teacher, and I've never seen that before. So that was interesting. I'm going to start by reading a poem by Rodney Jones. This is from the Best American Poetry 2010, and there are three characters in this poem, the speaker and a father and son team, Early and Tabor. Their last name is Turrentine. They're not related to the Pittsburgh Turrentines. That would be Stanley and Tommy. This poem is called North Alabama in Time. I am going to read my own poems, but I wanted to start off with this one. North Alabama End Time by Rodney Jones. Early has come to my house on Sunday in a Chevy Nova to say that the world is ending. Anyone can see it, he says. The signs are right before us, your global warming, your famine and pestilence, your jihads and holy wars. I don't know, I say to Early. Maybe the physics guys see it. Quarks, muons, neutrinos. The building blocks of matter are naked as pole dancers to those geniuses. But us, we read, but we're ignorant. We're like goats eating paper. No, it's scripture, says Early. It's right there in Revelations. The world is going to end. You've hardened your heart. People are going to cry, says Early's oldest boy, Tabor, and look straight at me for the rocks to fall on them. I can nearly see that, I tell Tabor. People get depressed. It seems like there's no way out. But then maybe they let it go a day. Something fantastic happens. They change prescriptions. A redhead moves to town. Yesterday I saved a turtle's life. You're too negative about the end of time, says Early. It's like anything different. You have to give it a chance. Strike while the iron is hot. And it's hot. It's very hot. The Battle of Armageddon has probably already started. I'd like to be more positive, I say, and I try, I really do. I read all I can about wars and the evil in men's hearts, but it's tough with the end. It's like the championship. Nothing is playing infinity. It looks to me like a dead tie. You're wrong, says Tabor. Good triumphs in the end. He's got you there, says Early. Good always whips evil's ass. Just wait. People are going to weep and gnash their teeth. Not that you will, he says. You're thinking that's a start. I hope it's not too late, I say, and wave as they drive off. Not bad men. Disturbed, maybe, but like all Turrentines, friendly. You can say anything to them. Probably they just got carried away. They meant to talk politics. The end of time was just a pretext. So I liked that poem a lot. I thought I'd read it. Read a few poems from The Snake Charmer's Daughter. What we've got over there, I've got two books plus the anthology that I did with Judy. There's a CD with Romella Kitchens and I with the Cap Gun Quartet. And there's also the a DVD. It's an interview with poems that was done with me at the City Books. It's called Michael Worster, the City Books Session, done by Ruth Ella Hendricks. So, you know, anybody who does not have all Worster, there it is, except The Cruelty of the Desert, which is not only out of print but unavailable. Also, Michael's book, Blackstone, is there, which is wonderful. Some of the Autumn House products, and I'm sure that Renee has copies of No Water. And I was thinking, in the context of the haiku, how's this? No water, black stone, the British detective. There you are. Here's a poem called One Man's Comment. Many of you know that I worked for the welfare department for many years, and this poem comes out of that. One Man's Comment. Because we tell our history to ourselves in images. Because Time and Newsweek come out with pictorial editions at the end of the year. Because we watch electronic boxes in the evening in our living rooms. Because of this, a man, denied assistance in Pittsburgh after a long wait in February, drops his trousers upon leaving the welfare office and goes running around the schoolyard across the street. This is one man's comment on the state of our economy. Later, he is seen in a doorway up Carson Street. He is sobbing, and his bare buttocks are cold on the hard step. I feel like I want to read to both sides of the room, but the problem is the mic is right here. So if I turn here, so I'm with you in spirit, even if I'm not looking at you. Thank you. Okay. Now here's a poem called A Baseball Dream. A Baseball Dream. I am in the far corner under the left field roof at Three River Stadium. I am with my mother. The Pirates are at bat. The first batter singles. The second batter singles. The third batter hits a ball to the outfield. Well hit, probably a double. I can't see because of the overhang. As he rounds first and heads to second base, I realize it is Jim Farrar. Two shots ring out. Police assemble quickly around the infield and are joined by a brass band. A flea market begins setting up. Now, one of the great things about that poem that you've witnessed, when I mentioned Jim Farrar, there was a chuckle over there. There's actually someone here who knows who Jim Farrar is. He was a supervisor with the welfare department, and I was certainly as surprised for him to be in my poem as he would have been to be in my poem. And when the poem was eventually published in a poetry journal, I actually gave him a copy because I felt it was the right thing to do, and he never commented. I think he was probably terrified. Here's a poem called Death Flag. What could be sadder than a television set in the rain, all alone in a leafy glade? Joel Lippmann said, no great artist falls in love with a machine. They've put a death flag over your house, and you've got no place to go. You've got a death flag over your house, and you've got nowhere to go. One more poem from The Snake Charmer's Daughter. Restaurant violinists. Every night in their tuxes, amid the Chateaubriand and the surf and turf, they play Shadow of Your Smile, Moon River, Somewhere Over the Rainbow. They're not penguins, they're distinguished musicians thrown out of prestigious symphony orchestras for drinking. They are geniuses. They have gray hair and style. Ask them. Ask them to play Paganini's Variations on a theme by Wieslowski. They'll love you. It will make it all somehow worthwhile. And I challenge you to go to your Encyclopedia of Classical Music and look up Wieslowski. I challenge you to do that. He was once the bad boy of Pittsburgh poetry, Dieter Wieslowski. Here's a poem called Return to Cape May. I'm now reading from the British Detective. It has an epigraph, a geographical epigraph, from room 214, the Jetty Motel, overlooking the Atlantic. I think of Canute, or was it Alfred, throne-born, carried by his men down to the sea's side, commanded, roll on, and by God it did, thus legitimizing the king. It still rolls on. Count. Benches on the promenade, a blue beach house, a rowboat lettered Cape May, a lifeguard chair, a red, green, and white beach umbrella. There is a hazy sky. It is hot. A few sunbathers dare the water, still cold in June, with their toes. Count. Seabirds, gulls or terns with their distinctive cry. They are the true ghosts of this place, if ghosts there be. Here's one called Geopolitics in November. Walking from my car, a plastic cup rattling across an empty street in the wind. I thought of the Orientals, Basho, etc., how they would find significance in this. Now, that poem was published in a magazine called Bog. John Ellsberg, the editor, wrote me, and he said, Michael, the title's too subtle for my readership. If you allow me to call it November, I'll publish it. So I said, okay, John, go ahead, which he did. But then when I put it in the book, I gave the original title back to it. Here's a poem called American Literature. Finally, a stranger at the end of the bar scanned us all and, apropos of nothing, said, a lot of people felt that way about Mexico, but when they got there, all they did was drink and die. Now here's a poem called Quiet House. Some of you know that I've been married a few times. Quiet House. In a quiet house at night, you can hear the cat eating dry food in the kitchen. Even in the city, you can hear the summer locusts. In a quiet house at night on a small street with silent parked cars, you think of waking your wife for sex, but don't. There's enough of it. Civilization is made possible by this courtesy. And here's one called Hyperbole or Notoriety with a question mark. Like my first wife who said, Michael, to you everything is bizarre, and it ain't necessarily so. Or as Kurt DeBoer, when I spotted Nikki Gutowski lurching up Forbes Avenue, Michael, just because you know them doesn't necessarily mean they're famous. At the picnic, you said you agreed with this. This is a problem I have, dramatizing my life. Thank you. One footnote, Kurt DeBoer, once a staunch member of Pittsburgh Poetry Exchange, left poetry for acting, apparently died suddenly several weeks ago. I was sorry to see his obituary in the paper. I have no idea what happened, but he was a splendid guy. So now we'll move on to some newer work, if we don't destroy the set. It's a poem called The Future. The earth grows cities, grows commerce, grows dark trees. Dark trees reach for wind, sun, music, even spirit. The future, however, becomes anchored in gluttonous debauchery. This one's called Soviet Socialist Love Tokens. I don't know if anybody here knew Jim Vail. He's still around, but he's not the same. Soviet Socialist Love Tokens. Jim Vail makes a film called Soviet Socialist Love Tokens. In it, a Russian film director, played by Jim, is making a film called Soviet Socialist Love Tokens. The director and his producer, played by Jim's brother Leo, travel all over Moscow scouting locations. The film is in Russian with English subtitles. But the city is clearly not Moscow, it's Pittsburgh. There's Smithfield Street. There's Kaufman's Clock. There's Ralph's Discount City. Some of the great projects that have gone on in this city is just amazing, and most of them are undocumented except for the odd poem like that. Here's a poem. Here's a poem called Kiss the Kitty. When Lloyd would come over, he would greet us, sit down on the couch. There was Samantha. We'd say, kiss the kitty. She'd always look so mortified when his lips touched her head. Now, some of these poems, like the last one and the one before that, are really true. They really happened. Here's one I made up. It's called James Dickey. I was reading with James Dickey. He read first. At the end of the intermission, as Dickey and I were re-entering the hall, there were a bunch of nuns, maybe 15 or 20, carrying picket signs, protesting against the war, I guess. I shouted out, equal pay for nuns. everyone thought that was funny. So I guess if we mention James Dickey, we have to mention a couple other people in the next poem. This poem's called Three Strangers in a Cold Room. It's in two parts. It's dedicated to John Berryman. Three Strangers in a Cold Room. One, the room was very cold. We drank coffee to stay warm. The chalk on the board imitated snow. The three strangers were fearful of slush and slick spots. A cat would have been welcome. Two, invisible mice squeak, frozen fur. Melting snow slides down the metal. The three strangers look forward to dinner. They stare into black mirrors, teeth flashing. The hungry one drives by in a gold automobile. Will his car be filled with food? Did James Wright solve the whole problem of Minneapolis? Spare the cat. There's a wonderful James Wright poem, which he's writing about a great Chinese poet that was around many centuries before, and he talks about solving the whole problem of Minnesota, and I just had to do something with that. Here's one called The Exhibitionist. This is another one that's absolutely true. You may have seen this guy, The Exhibitionist. At festivals and outdoor concerts, he would get up and dance. Long, dark gold hair, a terrific physique, little green bathing trunks. Pat would say, "See that guy? He's a bum. He doesn't work." He had been a friend of her brother. Later, I found out he wasn't a bum. I said, "Pat, he's not a bum. He's a guitar hero. Ninth grade boys all over the city want to grow up to be him." She was never convinced. Now, here's one that's a version of a poem by somebody else. Dalila Akal wrote this poem in French, and she sent it to me. She translated it into English, and she sent it to me, and I rewrote it as a poem because once it was in English, it wasn't really very poetic anymore. French, of course, it's impossible not to rhyme, and there's a lot more repetition. So this is my version of Dalila's poem. It's called A Violet in the Snow. A violet in the snow, my favorite colors, indelible trace of our love. A violet in the snow, a blink to our past, memory of an instant, the landmark of our story. A violet in the snow, a drop of ink on white paper. A violet in the snow, I kiss you, I caress your skin, I hear the sound of violins. A violet on the snow, lipstick on your skin. And here's a poem dedicated to Barbara Escalado, whom some of you may know. It's called I Had a Dream About You Last Night. In the first part of the dream, we were riding bicycles together and having a conversation. In the second, you were conducting a poetry workshop in your home, which was in a small mining town north of Pittsburgh. Rick St. John was there, and Krista Wolf, and some others. There was a bird's nest with an egg, a jar of marmalade, and a book of poems by Jack Gilbert. You were happy, and I was happy, to be in your company. Now here's a poem that begins with a young woman named Tawanda. So here's the poem. It's called Tawanda. If I were 30 years younger, I'd pick you up in the morning. We'd drive to Tawanda and knock on Tom DeWitt's door. I'd introduce you. Tom, I'd say, I want you to meet Tawanda. Forgive an old man's ramblings. I remember once we were in the proscenium, a Philadelphia coffee house. An old guy called the Prophet was preaching from the stage. On and on he went. When he finished, there was only one thought. Might he start up again? Tom bounded to the stage. Prophet, he said, you've entertained me. Now I'll entertain you. Sat down at the piano and gave us an hour's worth of the best, jazz and boogie-woogie. I wish you'd been there. And later I found out her name was spelled differently than the town, but What the heck? There's two versions, one with the name corrected by hand. But that's too subtle for editors, so that's not the one I'm sending out. My notebook seems to be getting thoughts of its own here. Here's a poem that's due to be in a magazine called Prasa. And why they chose this one, I don't know. Maybe somebody will tell me. It's called The Old Man. I dreamt I was a stinky old man, and the police came and treated me rudely and took the pictures away from off my walls. Let me straighten out this book and just take a second. What they say about Worcester is true. There's not even any technology to this notebook here, and it's still beyond me. Now here's one. If Judy were here, I couldn't read it because it would upset her. But since she's in South Carolina, I'll read it. It's called Die in Bed. I keep telling Judy to make up my die in bed. She won't do it, rejects the notion. Many of her people died too young. I'm not young. The date on my expiration label reads summer 2004. Now here's a poem called Frank, A True Story. It's not about Frank Carreni, it's a different Frank. Frank liked to drink and drive. One night he went off the road and broke every bone in his body. After the doctors put him together again, Frank became known for sporting a fancy cane. One night Frank was playing cards in West Virginia. Somebody was cheating. Frank's cane was a sword cane. He left a man dead on the floor. The other players threw the body down into the ravine and continued the game. Playing cards for money is illegal in West Virginia. I'm going to do three more. This one's called Lum-de-Day. Now, there are poets, even in our own community, who can sing, and they have beautiful voices. I am not among them. But this poem requires me to sing. So this will be like when Arthur Godfrey sang Wagon Wheels in the Little Abner comic strip. The poem is called Lum-de-Day. Lum-de-Day. It's in two parts. One, some of these days you'll be sorry. You never know what a friend you have till he's gone away. Sometimes Patton sang as if he had mashed potatoes in his mouth. Lum-de-day. Two. I was driving to the home of friends for Easter dinner. Beautiful weather. I was listening to a recording of Jeff Moldauer singing Charlie Patton's Some of Those Days. Tears were streaming down my face. Some of these days, you're gonna miss me. Some of these days, I am going away. So I'm gonna do two more poems, and I wanna remind you that next week will be four Pittsburgh Poetry Exchange All-Stars reading. Walt Peterson, Judy Robinson, Shankar Roy, and Arlene Wiener. I will be in Philadelphia, so I'm gonna count on the rest of you to be here and to support them. So that's another announcement there for you. Two more poems. This one is called Pain. Pain inhabits the body, interdicting the imagination. It paroles the fields at dusk, making the birds crazy. You can't get used to it. You get too used to it, have no idea how it is limiting you, how much, how it can be justified lying so close to our bodies in the night. The doll talks when the string is pulled. Another version of pain, the birds around her head. Burma, how many varieties of bamboo? Later, under the fingernails. So there's a little lesson for you. If somebody says, well, how do you get out of a poem? One way to get out of a poem is to reach back into the past and take something from an earlier poem that has resonance with what you're talking about, and boom, you've got your ending. That's what I did there. The last poem I'm going to read is called Sparrow. Sparrow becomes an altered view. The owlish border between sand and sea disperses. Atlantic City before the casinos. I'm sorry to have gone so long without writing. I trim its feathers, the small particles falling. That's it. Thank you.